Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Rodas v. Sedlin and Ms. O'Leary.
May it please the Court, my name is Margaret O'Leary. I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff, Gloria Rodas, and I thank you for the opportunity to have this oral argument today. I'd like to start by touching on the issue of subject matter jurisdiction, making a few points in that regard. As you know, the district court held that removal of the case from state court under Section 1442A was improper, and I submit it was improper for three reasons. Section 1442A authorizes removal by the United States of an action commenced in state court. This case was commenced against the United States in November of 2003 in the U.S. District Court, from which it was dismissed without prejudice. Any filing thereafter, any filing of the claim, was a refiling, which is not authorized by the specific language of Section 1442A. Secondly, the 1442A requires that the removal be done before acts done under color of office. And case law requires that the defendant plead in their notice of removal facts showing that the conduct on which the state case is based were acts done under color of office. And the government did not do that in this instance. Since the defendant, United States, is a sovereign, it can only act through its employees and agents. Dr. Baxter and Crusader Clinic, on whose conduct the state case is based, were not employees of the government. Therefore, the government would have to show that the, according to the standard applied to private actors who remove cases from the state court under Section 1442A. In other words, the government would have to plead facts in their notice of removal or otherwise show that the conduct of Dr. Baxter and Crusader Clinic were done at the direction of a federal officer. And they did not do that. And I suggest if you look at the allegations of the complaint, it defies common sense to say that a federal officer directed them to do the things alleged in the complaint. Lastly, the nature of the claim here does not fall within the ambit of Section 1442A and its purposes. If this case had been permitted to continue in state court, it would not impede the enforcement of federal law. It would not impede the operation of the government, which are two of the main purposes for allowing removal under Section 1442A. And then as the district court held, Section 2679D2 does allow for removal of the case from state court and provides subject matter jurisdiction. Now, turning to the Good Samaritan Act, I submit that the district court's decision strikes at the heart of what the Good Samaritan Act is commonly understood to be and what the statutory purpose says it is to be. The Good Samaritan Act is meant to protect physicians who give their time and talents free of charge to provide emergency care. It's not meant to protect physicians being paid to provide emergency services or those physicians charging patients for their care. Under the language of the statute, it is illogical to immunize physicians who patients pay for their care and when their physician is getting paid. Now, the key prong that's at issue here is the without fee element of the case, which simply was not satisfied by Dr. Selenikoff. All of the Illinois cases that look at the without fee prong, look to see whether the patient was charged or whether the physician received a fee or both. Several of them say that the services must be gratuitous. On the one hand, Ms. Rodas was charged a fee for Dr. Solonikov's emergency care. And on the other hand, Dr. Solonikov was paid for her professional services on August 2nd, 2001. For these reasons, we say that the without fee prong has not been satisfied.
Let me ask you this question. What if a doctor happened upon a sick stranger on the street, tried to help the stranger, couldn't do it, stranger dies? It turns out that the stranger the doctor helped was a patient at the hospital where the doctor was employed. Would that doctor be entitled to immunity under the Illinois Good Samaritan Act, or would her compensation by the stranger's hospital preclude protection? So in other words, the doctor doesn't know that the stranger he's helping is a patient at the hospital, just helps the person on the street.
As originally contemplated by the statute, I think the doctor would be entitled to immunity in that instance because the assistance is totally divorced from his relationship with the hospital.
Which is very different than the situation here.
Oh, very different. I would submit that the district court's finding that the submission of billing documents by Dr. Solonikov does not equate to a fee is contrary to statutory construction. The most glaring aspect is because it eliminates the good faith requirement for physicians who do not charge a fee. You cannot assess whether or not their failure to charge a fee was done in good faith. So I believe that ruling by the court is incorrect. If this court finds that ruling is incorrect, then I believe the court then would have to look at Dr. Solonikov's complaint that the or allegation that she did not charge a fee. And she contends she did not charge a fee because she did not bill patients directly. There was no evidence that she had input into the fee. Well, if that is the case, if the issue comes to looking at that aspect of Dr. Solonikov's claim, I submit there's a question of fact as to whether or not there was any input into determining the amount of the fee and to whether or not it was her fee. We have the billing documents by Dr. Solonikov, the agreement for professional services require that they follow billing procedures or follow procedures leading to a bill. The bill was itemized for emergency services. We know she's employed with the University of Illinois and receives a salary, and therefore she assigned her rights to bill to them. Then UIC assigned their rights to Crusader Clinic to do the physical building. Further, there's evidence in this agreement for professional services at page 13 of the agreement that actually it appears to be more of a joint venture where University of Illinois negotiated with Crusader Clinic for financial consideration as well as other valuable consideration. And if the Women's Health Services made more than the sum of the expenses, then University of Illinois would get 50% of that amount over the expenses. I'd like to touch briefly on Dr. Seidlin. Dr. Seidlin seems to want to affirm summary judgment on the basis of his care to Gloria Rodas was merely fortuitous, but both Dr. Baxter and Dr. Solonikov say that he was there by agreement to stand in for Dr. Solonikov, and Dr. Baxter knew that he would have to go to Dr. Seidlin if Dr. Solonikov was not available. Further, his billing records from that day show that he did perform a surgery and billed for another surgery. There is ample evidence that his billing was not done in good faith, or ample evidence showing a conflict between his evidence and the plaintiff's evidence. The agreement for professional services gave no discretion to not bill, and there was a special billing code for assisting in cesarean sections. And under the Hernandez case, he couldn't say that there was any other time that he did not bill women's health patients because of minimal involvement. That would give rise to a question of fact as to his good faith. I see my time is up.
Almost. You have until the red light. So if you have an additional comment, you're not constitutionally required to use your time. So.
All right. For my 10 minutes, does that mean?
Well, you're eating into your rebuttal time.
You know? You have. There is no rebuttal.
Oh, that's right. There's no rebuttal.
There's no rebuttal.
Well, you reserved
10 minutes.
Ten minutes. Oh, excuse me. I take it back. You do. You've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
You're into it.
Yeah.
You're into your rebuttal time.
All right. Well, I will turn the
All right. Now, Ms. Kersmag, how close is that? Kasvan?
Kasvan.
Von, okay. All right. So the G is silent.
Well, it's not entirely silent, but it's that Scandinavian Vong.
Okay.
So, may it please the court, I am here for the United States. I do want to start by quickly addressing our jurisdictional argument. It's actually fairly straightforward. The Federal Tort Claims Act creates exclusive jurisdiction in the federal courts for civil actions for money damages against the United States. Plaintiff sued the United States in state court. The derivative jurisdiction doctrine, as this court explained in Edwards, says that if the state court lacks jurisdiction, the federal court does not acquire jurisdiction, even if a like suit originally filed in federal court would have been within the court's jurisdiction. That applies to suits removed under 1442. Congress eliminated it as to 1441, but left it in place as to 1442. This appeal here and this 54B judgment, the district court's jurisdiction was supplemental to the jurisdiction in the suit against the United States. So since there was no jurisdiction over the suit against the United States, there is no jurisdiction here.
So it doesn't matter that under the Federal Tort Claims Act, this court would have jurisdiction. You know, and then the because the United States could have approached this in a different manner, and it would still be here. I mean, this is the proper place for it, and so I'm having a hard time understanding why we shouldn't have jurisdiction.
Well, because the way in which the suit was filed really does matter under the derivative jurisdiction doctrine, which is still in place for removals under 1442. The Fourth Circuit recently addressed a case like this in Palmer, and the Fourth Circuit said, you know, that suit was a tort and contract claim against the United States, so it could have started in federal court. The court said, again, because of this derivative jurisdiction doctrine for suits removed under 1442, we don't have jurisdiction. And, of course, this suit was properly removed under 1442. 1442 provides for removal of suits against the United States in state court. This suit was against the United States, filed in state court against the United States. So it was removed under 1442. It wasn't filed against an employee of the United States. There was an earlier suit filed against an employee of the United States, but that was, of course, dismissed. Suit is commenced against the United States when the United States is added as a party, not, of course, when the complaint is filed. Otherwise, we would have a situation where people could initially name private parties, and then amend their complaint to name the United States, and the United States would never be able to remove those cases. The district court seemed to think that removal under the Westfall Act was proper. That's simply incorrect. That act only applies where the defendant is an employee. It says in the act, you know, the defendant employee. Here, of course, the defendant was the United States. Quickly, also, Grubbs does not apply in this case. District Court relied on Grubbs as a secondary reason for leaving this judgment in place. Grubbs was really the opposite of this case. There was a problem with the removal, but there was no problem with jurisdiction. The Supreme Court has since clarified in Caterpillar and Grupo Dataflex that where a jurisdictional defect remains uncured, the judgment has to be vacated. I'm almost out of time. I would quickly like to address the Good Samaritan Act issue. The defendants seem to understand our argument to be that the doctors weren't Good Samaritans because they had a duty to treat Mrs. Rodas. Of course, our argument is not that. It is that they aren't Good Samaritans because they were getting paid. This is a statute that, in the words of the Illinois legislature, is about people who are volunteering their time and talent to help others. To the extent there's any ambiguity, you look at the legislative history, which makes it very clear that the act is not intended to provide immunity for people acting for pay in the line of duty. And that for pay in the line of duty really does answer Your Honor's question about the doctor who is driving along on their own time. There they aren't acting for pay in the line of duty. That's why Neal versus Yang has nothing to do with this case. That in that case, the doctor was not getting a fee. There was no claim that the doctor got a fee. The issue was whether the fact that the doctor had some kind of obligation but wasn't getting paid would be enough. I see that I'm out of time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. John Rath.
Good morning. My name is Craig Unrath, and I represent Dr. Seidlin. This is my first foray into the tangled, formulaic mess known as the doctrine of derivative jurisdiction. I've never encountered this before in my practice, and I have to tell you I'm a bit stunned that our judicial system spends so much time working with it. The entire purpose of a removal statute is to provide the government with a forum, the option of trying their case in a federal forum. What difference does it make if the state court has jurisdiction or not? There is nothing in any of the removal statutes themselves that require derivative jurisdiction. There's nothing in there. This is judge-made law. One judge referred to it as a judge-made gloss on the removal statutes. Same judge described removal or derivative jurisdiction as rigmarole, unworthy of a civilized judicial system. Now, if derivative jurisdiction applied in this case, I would be urging this court to abandon it, to take a bold step and just dispense with it entirely. But unfortunately, or actually perhaps fortunately, this is not the proper vehicle for that such bold action. Derivative jurisdiction, the doctrine simply does not apply.
I don't think any of the three of us are feeling overly bold, so go ahead.
Okay. My argument supporting jurisdiction in the federal court is pretty straightforward. It comes down to this. Judge Kapala got it right. I would like to give this court a very brief review of the procedural history of this case. The case was commenced in state court against individual Crusader defendants. The federal government stepped in, removed it to federal court, filed a motion to dismiss, saying that you haven't exhausted your administrative remedies. Motion granted. Was the case dismissed? No. The case was remanded to state court, where it remained pending. It's still alive. Plaintiff's counsel went off, exhausted her administrative remedies, and filed an amended complaint. Now, the amended complaint, for the first time, named the United States as party defendant. This is something that the United States would have done on its own. They would have forced that issue immediately had she filed the complaint the same way as the initial complaint, had the amended complaint named individual Crusader defendants. The federal government would have stepped in immediately and under the Public Health Service Act substituted itself for those defendants. Well, I guess plaintiff's counsel took a bit of a shortcut. She named them, the federal government, in the amended complaint as a party defendant. That does not mean the suit commenced. One doesn't commence a suit with an amended complaint. You commence a suit with the initial complaint. Accordingly, Judge Coppola looked at this and said, Section 1442 simply cannot apply because this case was not commenced against the United States in state court. Judge Coppola found that jurisdiction was appropriate under 28 U.S.C. 2679 and 42 U.S.C. 233. And thank heaven, no court that we are aware of has ever associated the doctrine of derivative jurisdiction with either of those statutes. And we urge this court not to extend this flawed doctrine any further than it already is. Even assuming the worst, assuming that this court does apply derivative jurisdiction to the two statutory removal sections that Judge Coppola cited, in the end, we are still saved by the Grubbs decision. It's because this case had already gone to judgment. We have a final ruling as to two defendants. And under Grubbs, when you wait until after final judgment to raise the jurisdictional problem, the issue of removal, the propriety of the removal, is no longer at issue. It's not no longer a consideration. The only consideration is whether the district court had jurisdiction over this case, and it clearly did. Put another way.
But Mr. Unruh, you've got to have jurisdiction at the time of the judgment.
And
that's the issue, isn't it?
And I believe that the court did have jurisdiction.
No, I appreciate your position, but Grubbs may not apply if there's no jurisdiction at the time. And that's what's at issue here.
If removal was proper under 28 U.S.C. 2679, the federal district court did have jurisdiction over this case to hear it and issue that ruling. It did issue that ruling. And the moment that final judgment came in as to these defendants, the entire issue of removal was eliminated. Now the only question you ask is, did the court have jurisdiction at the time it entered the ruling? And it clearly did. One of this court's decisions put it another way.
Let me go back for a minute, because when the district court granted the dismissal of the claims against the United States, you said, I mean, that was a dismissal without prejudice, correct?
Yes, combined with a remand. And it's the remand that's essential here. The plaintiff was not required to refile an initial complaint in state court. Federal court dismissed the action, found it had no jurisdiction, dismissed it without prejudice, and remanded to the state court. And that is, I believe, the key to this entire jurisdictional issue. This court has stated that the federal government cannot be permitted to invoke the jurisdiction of the federal courts and then disclaim that jurisdiction after it loses. Now, the federal government has not lost in this case. What they've found is that they are the sole remaining defendant. But the same rule applies. The court, in all fairness, the federal government cannot bring us into federal court, wait for a judgment, determine how the case is going, wait until after judgment is entered, and then change its mind and say, no, wait a minute. No, we think that our own removal to this court was flawed. Find something just fundamentally wrong with that. Now, as to the merits of the case, I take issue with a statement in the amicus's statement of facts and with a statement that opposing counsel just made suggesting that there's a statement of or an issue of fact as to whether Dr. Seidlin was on call on the day of this occurrence. But Dr. Seidlin was not on call. He was not scheduled to see any patients. He was in civilian clothes. They call him civilian clothes. I imagine that means he was not wearing scrubs. He didn't have a stethoscope around his neck. He was there. Well, quite frankly, he doesn't recall why he was there. He thinks he was there to work on academic matters. He stopped by the office.
But he billed for a different patient's medical procedure on the day he chose not to bill Ms. Rodas. Why doesn't that doom an argument that he wasn't working that day?
Your Honor, the facts on that, the mere fact that he billed a surgery later in the day, he may have been called in. We don't know. There are very little facts on that. All we know is that at the time that he was called in to see Ms. Rodas, he was not scheduled to even be on the premises that day.
Well, so he could have been called in to do this surgery, and he billed for that.
He was not called in to do this surgery, though. And I think
a different patient's medical procedure. He was involved in that. All I'm suggesting is he could have been called in to that medical procedure.
He could have.
And he billed that day.
Yes, he did.
So there's a little inconsistency there.
I don't see any inconsistency because I'd like to focus on the facts that were present with Ms. Rodas, which is at that time he was not even supposed to be in the hospital.
Well, according to you, he wasn't. He wasn't supposed to be there. He was there for some academic purpose. All I'm saying is he did something else that day in terms of treating a patient.
Yes.
Yes.
The fact is that he was not scheduled to be Dr. Solonikov's backup on that day. And when he was asked about Ms. Rodas and told that there was a difficult delivery, he did not rush to Ms. Rodas' bedside. He did what he was supposed to do. He helped out. He didn't have to help out. He could have said, I'm not on call. Find somebody else. It's Dr. Solonikov's duty. Go find her yourself. He helped out. And it seems to me that that is precisely what the Good Samaritan Act is designed to do. He didn't have to do what he did. And when he did help out, and when it was determined that Ms. Rodas was going to go to surgery, he looked around. They needed an assistant. There wasn't one there. That's why he was in that surgical theater.
Right. But then he's on the payroll. He's on the payroll. And so, I mean, don't you think a doctor should respond like that? And that isn't that part of his responsibility when someone is not there and his services are needed and he's on the payroll, that he should respond? I mean, it's not like he's responding, and it's not like he was out on the street, like in that hypothetical I gave where, you know, he's out on the street, it's a stranger, he's nowhere near the hospital, he doesn't even know the patient is related to the hospital, he helps out. That I can understand. That would cover the Good Samaritan Act, but I'm having difficulty understanding why he shouldn't be responsible. Because then you could have just docs that could hang out, that could say, you know, I'm here, I'm just doing some academic work, and, you know, they get called in on things, and then they're immune from suit.
Your Honor, the Illinois appellate courts have addressed this on numerous occasions. As a matter of fact, almost all of the Good Samaritan cases involve hospitals, doctors working in clinics and hospitals. I don't believe there are any cases out there where we have a doctor on the street who just happened by. This court may disagree with some of those rulings, but the conclusion is the same. This is how the Illinois courts have interpreted the act. They've interpreted it broadly. They have found that the fact that a doctor has a pre-existing duty is of no relevance. They have found that the fact that a doctor may have benefited indirectly through the provision of the medical services is irrelevant. Under these circumstances, I see no alternative in a case involving Dr. Seidlin that this court should affirm the dismissal. He did not have to do what he did, but he helped out. It is precisely for that reason that we have the Good Samaritan Act. I think that he is a textbook example of what the Good Samaritan Act was designed to do. Most importantly, Dr. Seidlin made no medical decisions. He was there to help out, to lend a hand. He was a second pair of hands. That's it. He went and he found Dr. Solonikov because he knew where she was. He did not make medical decisions, and that substantiates not only the application of the Good Samaritan Act, but it also explains why there was no reason for him to issue a record of his time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ms. O'Brien?
May it please the Court. I'm Deborah O'Brien, and I'm from Lewis and Gellin, here on behalf of Dr. Solonikov. And I'd like to pick up where Mr. Unrath left off. The critical issue here, Your Honors, is the standard of review. Since we're dealing with a matter of state law, the Illinois Good Samaritan Act, this court is to decide the case as it thinks that the Illinois Supreme Court would decide it. And since there are no Illinois Supreme Court decisions on point,
right,
the Illinois appellate court decisions that are on point control here.
Can you point to an Illinois appellate court decision which focuses on this kind of fact pattern?
I can, Your Honor. The Hanyu case is very, very close in the factual situation. It's very close to the facts that we have here. In that case,
that's where the doctor has not sent a bill, right?
Well, there was a bill sent. In fact, the defendant doctor in that case was the partner of the treating physician. And he was called in to assist his partner's patient when the other partner couldn't be found. And the medical practice did send a bill to the emergency patient. Now, there was no specific line item for the emergency treatment. Your Honor's
right.
Correct on that. But many thousands of dollars were billed to this patient by the partnership. And what the Hanyu court said was that the doctor that provided the emergency care did indeed receive an indirect financial benefit because of the care that he provided in the practice. But that just isn't enough to rise to the level of a fee under the Illinois Good Samaritan Act. The way fee has been interpreted.
Well, let's go back to the legislative intent on this without fee provision. It seems that the congressional intent was that doctors be granted immunity so long as they did not directly bill, but that they be granted immunity if they were not compensated. And during the floor debate, one of the representatives said, just to clarify this, it only covers services that are rendered without compensation. Is that correct? And the sponsor responded, that is correct. If a person is serving under, for pay in his line of duty, this Good Samaritan bill would not affect that. He would still be liable for lawsuits. It's only when there is no compensation. And so it seemed that the sponsor was concerned about the scenario you're asking us to address that this bill didn't cover.
I believe Your Honor is referring to the 1996 floor debates when...
I thought it was 1999, but I could be wrong.
Okay.
I could be off on the date.
All right. What I think Your Honor is referring to is the debate that took place when the Good Samaritan Act statutes were all compiled. What they did in 1996, and I think it became effective in 1997, was they went through and they took all of these civil immunity provisions that were scattered throughout the code and they recodified them in Section 45. And so in Section 45, you'll find many different civil immunities. 25 is what we're talking about here today, and that relates to physicians who treat in an emergency. But there are things in there about civil immunity for 911 operators.
Well, that's fine, but I'm just saying the bill's sponsor, who, when he was dealing with this specific Good Samaritan bill, clarified that.
Well, what they were discussing during that floor debate, Your Honor, was a general statement that would precede this collection of immunity statutes. And that was just the debate to codify all of these statutes in one location. That's the Section 2 that they were discussing during that floor debate is specifically addressed in the Neal case, Your Honor. And the Neal court looked at it and saw that, yes, that's part of the Good Samaritan Act, which encompasses all of these many provisions, but Section 2 does not specifically say that a doctor acting under Section 25 has to be a volunteer or has to give the emergency care completely free of charge. That's just not what Section 2 says, and it doesn't need to be considered when we're interpreting Section 25, because Section 25 is unambiguous. We only look to the plain language of Section 25, and that's what Neal and also Hanyu found, that the term fee, as it's used in Section 25, should be interpreted without reference to any outside debates, or we don't even need to look to what the legislature said when any of these provisions were passed, because we just have to apply a plain language approach to the term fee. And applying this plain language approach, the Hanyu court said that what fee means is a very specific sort of relationship where the economic benefit to the physician who renders care is derived specifically from that care that's provided. And that's the key here, Your Honor. Dr. Selennikov did not get any direct benefit from the care, the emergency care that she provided to Gloria Rodas.
Let me ask you this. Since the Illinois Supreme Court, as Judge Flom pointed out, has not considered the meaning of the fee requirement within the Illinois Good Samaritan Act, would it be appropriate for us to certify a question to that court to allow it to consider the scope of the fee requirement?
I don't think that would be appropriate, Your Honor, because I think it's very clearly decided in the appellate court decisions. All this court has to do is to look to those appellate court decisions, and I think that the case is disposed by them, just as the district court found. The facts in this case clearly show, Your Honors, that Dr. Selennikov didn't get a direct benefit from the emergency care that she provided. Neither she nor her employer billed Gloria Rodas for the services. It doesn't make any difference, Your Honors, that Dr. Selennikov documented the care she provided. All doctors document what they do, but this wasn't a bill. The documentation was used by Gloria Rodas' health care provider, the Crusader Clinic, to generate a bill, sure. But Dr. Selennikov didn't issue that bill, and her employer didn't issue that bill. The Crusader Clinic issued the bill to Medicaid, and Medicaid paid the Crusader Clinic. Dr. Selennikov didn't get the benefit of any of those proceeds. She didn't have any involvement in collecting or issuing the bill for them. Also, Your Honors, Medicaid was billed a flat rate for Gloria Rodas's delivery and her postpartum care. There was no specific line item for the emergency care that Dr. Selennikov rendered here. And so what we can take from that is that there was no payment specifically for what Dr. Selennikov did. Finally, Your Honors, I think it's really important to note on this issue that this was not Dr. Selennikov's primary job responsibility. Her primary job responsibility was not to serve as a backup for Crusader patients. This was really a very, very small part of what she did. In fact, she was in another surgery with a different patient at the time she was called to help out. And Gloria Rodas had been being treated at Swedish American for about 8 hours, I believe, before Dr. Selennikov was even called in to help. Gloria Rodas was not her patient. She was unfamiliar with her, and she was just called in at the very last minute to help in this emergency. This is exactly the type of a situation that the Illinois Good Samaritan Act is supposed
And being called in, it would be your position then that being called in because you're on staff is not within sort of the, is that within the scope of her duties at the hospital?
Yes, Your Honor, it was within the scope of her duties. But that doesn't matter under Neal. Even if she had a pre-existing duty to step in and to help in this emergency, that doesn't mean that she's not immunized under the Act. She acted in good faith.
So if it was within the scope of her duties, that's part of what she gets compensation for, her various duties, right? I mean, she gets paid. There are various duties that she has to respond to as a doctor I understand this wasn't her primary assignment, but it's within the scope of her duties to respond when she's called in.
Of course, Your Honor. But Dr. Solonikoff didn't get paid any more for helping out in Gloria Rodas's emergency. She got paid the same annual salary by UIC that she would have been paid if she didn't help out.
And what if she had said, you know, this isn't my assignment. I refuse to take this. Do you think that would have had some impact on her position there or might have affected her salary?
I don't know, Your Honor. We don't have any facts either way on that. That's not what she did. Dr. Solonikoff did her best to help when she was called in this emergency.
I was just trying to explore the relationship between her duty and her compensation, that's all. I understand that's not part of the record.
Ms. O'Brien, is every physician in an emergency room in an Illinois hospital who isn't obviously the primary care physician for, let's say, an accident victim that's traveling through the area and ends up in that room, is your position because their staff paid them, I'm thinking of interns and the like, that they're immunized because there's no fee, they're just employees of the hospital?
No, Your Honor, that's not my position.
I'm just wondering whether that would flow from your position. because I'm not familiar with the emerging change in the medical field, but it seems to me that in emergency rooms across the state, I suspect many people are attended to by physicians such as the type that Judge Williams has described, who are just salaried contract employees of the hospital.
I see that I'm out of your...
Well, you can respond.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, you're not getting off the hook that easy.
Your Honor, I think you would really have to consider the facts that were at issue in each individual case, how the bills were issued, how the doctor was paid, and all I can really say is that under the facts that we have at issue here, under the Illinois appellate court decisions that apply, Dr. Solonikoff did not charge a fee, so she is immunized under the Act.
Let me just ask you this. So if there was some great, horrible car accident and lots of people had to get to this hospital, were brought to this hospital because it was the closest one, and they called in people that were not on duty as emergency doctors. That's their job, to be emergency doctors. Because they were not on duty and they responded to the call, they would be immune. I mean, what we're trying to do is push this to, because there's some real consequences in terms of what, this decision. So would they not be, they wouldn't bill extra. I mean, there'd just be the general billing, they wouldn't get extra fees for that, right? Because they're on the emergency room staff. They're being paid. They just get called in because they're, 10 people brought into the ER at the same time. So they would all be immune from suit?
Well, if there was a claim of liability, Your Honor, perhaps there may be.
Yeah, let's assume there was a claim of liability.
But again, it would depend on whether or not the doctors acted in good faith, whether or not they billed.
I'm saying they didn't bill. Under my scenario, they don't bill. They're called in to respond to an emergency. They render treatment. There's some problem. There's a lawsuit. People sue. you know, people, the patients are billed, you know, for emergency care. You know, if there was a surgery or whatever, they're billed like that. But the doctors don't pick up any extra compensation because they came in and they responded to the call because they're on salary.
It is possible that they would be entitled to immunity under the Good Samaritan Act under those facts, Your Honor, but we would have to look at all of the elements of the statute when we determine that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you
for that. Okay. Ms. O'Leary?
Before you leap in, let me give you another piece of a scenario. I'm asking you the question. Yes.
I'm sorry.
So before you start, I want to start. See? If a doctor was leaving the building, having completed whatever tour of duty he had, he is not a member of the staff's office, he's going to the emergency room, and he sees an emergency that requires some assistance, and he jumps in himself. Is he under the Samaritan Act?
He is a member of the staff.
He's on the staff of the hospital. That is, every doctor that has a patient in there is on the staff, and he's a member. He has a staff position. He's not paid by the hospital.
I would submit he probably could assert immunity under the Good Samaritan.
Could he successfully assert immunity? Is no question. Anybody can assert it. I mean.
Well, probably because in this instance, Judge, Dr. Spolenikoff and Simon.
No. I'm talking about mine.
All right.
Can he successfully assert the Good Samaritan Act? I'm on my way out.
Yes.
Go to the car. I see a problem, and I jump in.
Because
not my patient.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
And we all agree this in our instant case, there's no relationship between the doctor and the patient prior to this thing, right?
In our case?
In your
yes,
case.
Yes, there is.
What's the relationship?
The relationship is that these two doctors work for women's health care.
But there's not a direct relationship to the patient and this doctor.
No, but that was the nature of the practice.
I understand.
I mean, my client, all she wanted to do was deliver a baby, healthy.
But I just want to follow up on Judge Bauer. So Judge Bauer's doctor was not on the staff of the hospital.
Yes, he was.
Was he paid? But that's what I'm trying to clarify.
Admitting privileges which makes him a member of the staff. You can look at the member of the staff.
Right. He's got admitted privileges, but his check doesn't come from the hospital. He's able to practice at the hospital. I'm just trying to clarify your hypothetical so I make sure I understand it. Is that right?
I'll go along with the program.
Oh, well, no. I just want to make sure I'm not confused because I was like, Joel, I wasn't. So the check in Judge Bauer's situation, the doc's check is not cut by the hospital under his scenario because this is a doctor who has privileges.
Correct.
Right. That, okay.
Now, a doctor like that has indirect benefits. If you've got privileges at a hospital,
right,
which lets you
that's true.
Admit patients and attend to them, you don't get a monthly or annual check from the hospital, but you do benefit from the hospital letting you participate.
Amen.
Right. I understand. That's kind of, you know, this reference in Hino about the indirect financial benefit,
mm-hmm.
that actually, in one way you can look at it, it's not new because in Blanchard they similarly said the benefit of operating the residency program would not entitle you to, or you still would be entitled to immunity, even though you get that type of benefit. But the benefit we're talking about here in this case is actual compensation for performing emergency services. These individuals were hired in the event an emergency occurred. And I just have to bring something up in response to Dr. Seidlin. Under the agreement for professional services, the chairman of the Department of OBGYN at UIC and the vice president or president of Crusader Clinic together made the schedule of who was going to be caring for these patients at Swedish American Hospital on August 2nd. And they are the ones who scheduled Dr. Baxter, knowing he had limited skills, and Dr. Selenikov. They also scheduled her for the surgeries. Now, it would be the height of irresponsibility to not have someone else available to help Dr. Baxter when Dr. Solonikoff was in the surgery. And that's why the, we know from that inference that Dr. Seidlin was on duty and he was in the hospital for that purpose that day. This is another issue, another piece of evidence.
You mean he had a legal obligation to do what he did?
Yes, or she did? He did. And because of this arrangement, before Ms.
He's not on call, he's not on duty, but he has a legal obligation to assist.
Well, he is on duty. He is on duty. The defense.
You mean they're like soldiers, are on duty 24 hours a day, 7 days a week?
He's on duty as long as Dr. Solonikoff was not available to help Dr. Baxter.
Is he on duty if he's in another town?
No, but, I mean, he was only on duty if he was in the hospital. That arrangement only applied when he was in the hospital.
For whatever reason. He's in visiting his mother and he still gets...
That would not. But they... That is
why not? He's in the hospital.
Well, I mean, if he was in visiting his mother, if he was on duty to stand in for Dr. Solonikoff, then he'd be on duty. But if he was visiting his mother because it was his day off, then he would not have the duty under... I beg your pardon?
His day off or just time off. He just has got 2 hours free himself. 3 hours?
If the reason Dr. Solonikoff was sent to the surgical room was because they knew that the agreement was that Dr. Seidlin would be able to fill in for her, then he was on duty, whether he's visiting his mother or not.
In your view, it's when he responds to the call. When he responds to the call, you're needed, get down here. That's when he is back on duty. Is that right?
Correct.
Under Judge Bowers, I'm just trying to, because we're all trying to spin out how far this thing goes and the implications of the thing. So once he responds, even if he is visiting his mother, your view is he's on duty. Responded to something as part of his duty.
Dr. Solonikoff was in surgery. Dr. Baxter says that. That's why he went after it when he went to Dr. Seidlin. I mean, it would be tantamount to abandonment by the Women's Health Service to not have somebody else there to fill in when Dr. Solonikoff was in surgery. I mean, it's inconceivable that they would operate that way, and I submit they did not. I would like to point out that, you know, there have only been 11 cases that have discussed the Good Samaritan Act.
Mm-hmm.
There have 9 of them, they have found immunity. In no case has the patient ever paid a fee and the physician been immunized. In no case have the doctors ever been compensated and been immunized. And in no case has the doctor who was scheduled to be in attendance of the patient been immunized. This is a completely different ball of wax in this case. And I understand that precedent requires that you give quite a bit of deference to Illinois appellate court cases. There is, other than picking selective parts of these cases, there is not a lot to give guidance on this particular fact situation. I would like also to point out that...
The closest case we have is, of course, not an Illinois case, but this Hensley case out of the Northern District of Illinois.
I would submit that's correct. But this Hensley was a harder case because the patient was not billed in Hensley. And, Your Honor, with reference to the various points that Dr. Seelan pointed out, at this stage, which is summary judgment, where there's facts on both sides, it's simply not an appropriate case for summary judgment. I'd like to lastly point out that as the order currently stands, liability will be eliminated for all emergency care given, except where the physician personally issues an itemized bill for emergency services. It virtually wipes out liability for emergency services, and that's why I submit the case of Hall versus Henn, even though it's on a different immunity statute, would demonstrate to the court the manner in which this Illinois Supreme Court would handle this issue if it were before him. And I submit to you the Illinois Supreme Court would not endorse the decision that Judge Capella entered because it would be too sweeping and defiant to other people. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Leary. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court